Chapter 8. Crime. No one had questioned him. No one had stopped him. There was that advantage, anyway, in the social isolation of a technician. He went via the kettle channels to a door to time and set its controls. There was the chance, of course, that someone would happen along on a legitimate errand and wonder why the door was in use. He hesitated, and then decided to stamp his seal on the marker. A sealed door would draw little attention. An unsealed door in active use would be a 9-day wonder. Of course, it might be Finge who stumbled upon the door. He would have to chance that. Noyes was still standing as he had left her. Wretched hours, physio hours, had passed since Harlan had left the 482nd for a lonely eternity, but he returned now to the same time, within a matter of seconds that he had left. Not a hair on Noyes's head had stirred. She looked startled. "Did you forget something, Andrew?" Harlan stared at her, hungrily, but made no move to touch her. He remembered Finge's words, and he dared not risk a repulse. He said stiffly, "You've got to do as I say." She said, "But is something wrong then? You just left. You just this minute left." "Don't worry," said Harlan. It was all he could do to keep from taking her hand, from trying to soothe her. Instead, he spoke harshly. It was as though some demon were forcing him to do all the wrong things. Why had he come back at the first available moment? He was only disturbing her by his almost instantaneous return after leaving. He knew the answer to that, really. He had a 2-day margin of grace allowed by the spatio-temporal chart. The earlier portions of that period of grace were safer and yielded least chance of discovery. It was a natural tendency to crowd it as far down when as he could. A foolish risk, too, though. He might easily have miscalculated and entered time before he had left it physio hours earlier. What then? It was one of the first rules he had learned as an observer. One person occupying 2 points in the same time of the same reality runs a risk of meeting himself. Somehow that was something to be avoided. Why? Harlan knew he didn't want to meet himself. He didn't want to be staring into the eyes of another and earlier or later Harlan. Beyond that, it would be a paradox. And what was it Twissell was fond of saying? "There are no paradoxes in time, but only because time deliberately avoids paradoxes." All the time Harlan thought dizzily of all this, Noyes stared at him with large, luminous eyes. Then she came to him and put cool hands on either burning cheek and said softly, "You're in trouble." To Harlan, her glance seemed kindly, loving. Yet how could that be? She had what she wanted. What else was there? He seized her wrists and said huskily, "Will you come with me now? Without asking any questions, doing exactly as I say?" "Must I?" she asked. "You must, Noyes. It's very important." "Then I'll come." She said it matter-of-factly, as though such a request came to her each day and was always accepted. At the lip of the kettle, Noyes hesitated a moment, then stepped in. Harlan said, "We're going up when, Noyes?"
"That means the future, doesn't it?"
The kettle was already faintly humming as she entered it, and she was scarcely seated when Harlan unobtrusively moved the contact at his elbow. She showed no signs of nausea at the beginnings of that indescribable sensation of motion through time. He was afraid she might. She sat there quietly, so beautiful and so at ease that he ached, looking at her, and gave not the particle of a damn that, by bringing a timer, unauthorized into eternity, he had committed a felony. She said,
"Does that dial show the numbers of the years, Andrew?"
"The centuries."
"You mean we're 1,000 years in the future already?"
"That's right."
"It doesn't feel like it."
"I know." She looked about.
"But how are we moving?"
"I don't know, Noyes."
"You don't?" There are many things about eternity that are hard to understand. The numbers on the temperometer marched. Faster and faster they moved till they were a blur. With his elbow, Harlan had nudged the speed stick to high. The power drain might cause some surprise in the power plants, but he doubted it. No one had been waiting for him in eternity when he returned with Noyes, and that was 9/10 the battle. Now it was only necessary to get her to a safe place. Again, Harlan looked at her. Eternals don't know everything.
And I'm not an Eternal, she murmured. I know so little.
Harlan's pulse quickened.
Still not an Eternal? But Finch said...
Leave it at that, he pleaded with himself. Leave it at that. She's coming with you. She smiles at you. What more do you want? But he spoke anyway. He said, You think an Eternal lives forever, don't you?
Well, they call them Eternals, you know, and everyone says they do.
She smiled at him brightly.
But they don't, do they?
You don't think so, then?
After I was in Eternity for a while, I didn't. People didn't talk as though they lived forever and there were old men there.
Yet you told me I lived forever, that night. She moved closer to him, along the seat, still smiling.
I thought, who knows?
He said, without being quite able to keep the strain out of his voice, How does a timer go about becoming an Eternal? Her smile vanished, and was it his imagination or was there a trace of heightened color in her cheek?
She said, Why do you ask that?
To find out.
It's silly, she said. I'd rather not talk about it.
She stared down at her graceful fingers, edged with nails that glittered colorlessly in the muted light of the kettle shaft. Harlan thought abstractedly and quite apropos of nothing that at an evening gathering with a touch of mild ultraviolet in the wall illumination, those nails would glow a soft apple green or a brooding crimson, depending on the angles she held her hands. A clever girl, one like Noyes, could produce half a dozen shades out of them and make it seem as though the colors were reflecting her moods. Blue for innocence, bright yellow for laughter, violet for sorrow, and scarlet for passion. He said, Why did you make love to me? She shook her hair back and looked at him out of a pale, grave face. She said,
If you must know, part of the reason was the theory that a girl can become an Eternal that way. I wouldn't mind living forever.
I thought you said you didn't believe that.
I didn't, but it couldn't hurt a girl to take the chance, especially...
He was staring at her sternly, finding refuge from hurt and disappointment in a frozen look of disapproval from the heights of the morality of his home when... Well...
Especially since I wanted to anyway.
Wanted to make love to me?
Yes.
Why me?
Because I liked you. Because I thought you were funny.
Funny?
Well, odd, if you like that better. You always worked so hard not to look at me, but you always looked at me anyway. You tried to hate me, and I could see you wanted me. I was sorry for you a little, I think.
What were you sorry about? He felt his cheeks burning.
That you should have such trouble about wanting me is such a simple thing. You just ask a girl. It's so easy to be friendly, why suffer?
Harlan nodded. The morality of the 482nd. Just ask a girl, he muttered.
So simple. Nothing more necessary. The girl has to be willing, of course. Mostly she is if she's not otherwise engaged. Why not? It's simple enough.
It was Harlan's turn to drop his eyes. Of course, it was simple enough. And nothing wrong with it either. Not in the 482nd. Who in eternity should know this better? He would be a fool, an utter and unspeakable fool, to ask her now about earlier affairs. He might as well ask a girl of his own home when, if she had ever eaten in the presence of a man, and how dared she? Instead, he said humbly,
And what do you think of me now? That you are very nice, she said softly, and that if you ever relaxed, won't you smile?
There's nothing to smile about, Noyes.
Please? I want to see if your cheeks can crease right. Let's see.
She put her fingers to the corners of his mouth and pressed them backward. He jerked his head back in surprise and couldn't avoid smiling.
See? Your cheeks didn't even crack. You're almost handsome. With enough practice, standing in front of a mirror and smiling and getting a twinkle in your eye, I'll bet you could be really handsome.
But the smile, fragile enough to begin with, vanished. Noyes said,
We are in trouble, aren't we?
Yes, we are, Noyes. Great trouble.
Because of what we did, you and I, that evening?
Not really.
That was my fault, you know. I'll tell them so if you wish.
Never, said Harlan with energy. Don't take on any fault in this. You've done nothing, nothing to be guilty for. It's something else.
Noyes looked uneasily at the temperometer. Where are we? I can't even see the numbers.
When are we? Harlan corrected her automatically. He slowed the velocity and the centuries came into view.
Her beautiful eyes widened and the lashes stood out against the whiteness of her skin. Is that right?
Harlan looked at the indicator casually. It was in the 72,000s. I'm sure it is.
But where are we going?
To when are we going? To the far up when, he said grimly. Good and far, where they won't find you. And in silence, they watched the numbers mount. In silence, Harlan told himself over and over that the girl was innocent of Finch's charge. She had owned up frankly to its partial truth, and she had admitted, just as frankly, the presence of a more personal attraction. He looked up then, as Noyes shifted position. She had moved to his side of the kettle, and, with a resolute gesture, brought the kettle to a halt at a most uncomfortable temporal deceleration. Harlan gulped and closed his eyes to let the nausea pass. He said, What's the matter?
She looked ashen and for a moment made no reply. Then she said, I don't want to go any further. The numbers are so high.
The temperometer read 111,394. He said, Far enough. Then he held out his hand gravely. Come, Noyes. This will be your home for a while. They wandered through the corridors like children, hand in hand. The lights along the main ways were on, and the darkened rooms blazed at the touch of a contact. The air was fresh and had a liveliness about it which, without sensible draft, yet indicated the presence of ventilation.
Noyes whispered, Is there no one here?
No one, said Harlan. He tried to say it firmly and loudly. He wanted to break the spell of being in a hidden century, but he said it in only a whisper after all. He did not even know how to refer to anything so far up when. To call it the 111,394th was ridiculous. One would have to say simply and indefinitely the 100,000s. It was a foolish problem to be concerned with, but now that the exaltation of actual flight was done with, he found himself alone in a region of eternity where no human footsteps had wandered, and he did not like it. He was ashamed, doubly ashamed since Noyes was witness, at the fact that the faint chill within him was the faint chill of a faint fear.
Noyes said, It's so clean. There's no dust.
Self-cleaning, said Harlan. With an effort that seemed to tear at his vocal cords, he raised his voice to near normal level. But no one's here, up when or down when, for thousands and thousands of centuries.
Noyes seemed to accept that. And everything is fixed up so? We passed food stores and a viewing film library. Did you see that?
I saw that. Oh, it's fully equipped. They're all fully equipped, every section.
But why, if no one ever comes here?
It's logical, said Harlan. Talking about it took away some of the eeriness. Saying out loud what he already knew in the abstract would pinpoint the matter, bring it down to the level of the prosaic. He said, early in the history of eternity, one of the centuries in the 300s came up with a mass duplicator. Do you know what I mean? By setting up a resonating field, Energy could be converted to matter with subatomic particles taking up precisely the same pattern of positions within the uncertainty requirements as those in the model being used. The result is an exact copy. We, in eternity, commandeered the instrument for our own purposes. At that time, there were only about 600 or 700 sections built up. We had plans for expansion, of course. 10 new sections a physio year was one of the slogans of the time. The mass duplicator made that all unnecessary. We built one new section complete with food, power supply, water supply, all the best automatic features, set up the machine and duplicated the section once each century, all along eternity. I don't know how long they kept it going, millions of centuries probably.
All like this, Andrew?
All exactly like this. And as eternity expands, we just fill in, adapting the construction to whatever fashion turns out to be current in the century. The only troubles come when we hit an energy-centered century. We haven't reached this section yet. No use telling her that the Eternals couldn't penetrate into time here in the hidden centuries. What difference did that make? He glanced at her, and she seemed troubled. He said hastily, "There's no waste involved in building the sections. It took energy, nothing more. And with the Nova to draw on..."
She interrupted. "No, I just don't remember."
"Remember what?"
"You said the duplicator was invented in the 300s. We don't have it in the 482nd. I don't remember viewing anything about it in history."
Harlan grew thoughtful. Although she was within 2 inches of being as tall as himself, he suddenly felt giant size by comparison. She was a child, an infant, and he was a demigod of eternity who must teach her and lead her carefully to the truth.
He said, "Noyes, dear, let's find a place to sit down and I'll have to explain something."
The concept of a variable reality, a reality that was not fixed and eternal and immutable, was not one that could be faced casually by anyone. In the dead of the sleep period, sometimes, Harlan would remember the early days of his cubhood and recall the wrenching attempts to divorce himself from his century and from time. It took 6 months for the average cub to learn all the truth, to discover that he could never go home again in a very literal way. It wasn't eternity's law alone that stopped him, but the frigid fact that home, as he knew it, might very well no longer exist, might, in a sense, never have existed. It affected cubs differently. Harlan remembered Bonky La Tourette's face turning white and gaunt the day Instructor Yarrow had finally made it unmistakably clear about reality. None of the cubs ate that night. They huddled together in search of a kind of psychic warmth, all except La Tourette, who had disappeared. There was a lot of false laughter and miserably poor joking. Someone said with a voice that was tremulous and uncertain, "I suppose I never had a mother. If I go back into the 95th, they'd say, 'Who are you? We don't know you. We don't have any records of you. You don't exist.'" They smiled weakly and nodded their heads, lonely boys with nothing left but eternity. They found La Tourette at bedtime, sleeping deeply and breathing shallowly. There was the slight reddening of a spray injection in the hollow of his left elbow, and fortunately, that was noted too. Yarrow was called, and for a while it looked as though one cub would be out of the course, but he was brought around eventually. A week later, he was back in his seat, yet the mark of that evil night was on his personality for as long as Harlan knew him thereafter. And now, Harlan had to explain reality to Noyes Lambent, a girl not much older than those cubs, and explain it at once and in full. He had to. There was no choice about that. She must learn exactly what faced them and exactly what she would have to do. He told her. They ate canned meats, chilled fruits, and milk at a long conference table designed to hold 12, and there he told her. He did it as gently as possible, but he scarcely found need for gentleness. She snapped quickly at every concept, and before he was half through it, was borne in upon him, to his great amazement, that she wasn't reacting badly. She wasn't afraid. She showed no sense of loss. She only seemed angry. The anger reached her face and turned it a glowing pink, while her dark eyes seemed somehow the darker for it.
"But that's criminal," she said. "Who are the Eternals to do this?"
"It's done for humanity's good," said Harlan. Of course, she couldn't really understand that. He felt sorry for the time-bound thinking of a timer.
"Is it? I suppose that's how the mass duplicator was wiped out."
"We have copies still. Don't worry about that. We've preserved it."
"You've preserved it. But what about us? We of the 482nd might have had it."
She gestured with little movements of two clenched fists. "It wouldn't have done you good. Look, don't get excited, dear, and listen." With an almost convulsive gesture, he would have to learn how to touch her naturally without making the movement seem a sheepish invitation to a repulse. He took her hands in his and held them tightly. For a moment, she tried to free them, and then she relaxed. She even laughed a bit.
"Oh, go ahead, silly, and don't look so solemn. I'm not blaming you."
"You mustn't blame anyone. There is no blame necessary. We do what must be done. That mass duplicator is a classic case. I studied it in school. When you duplicate mass, you can duplicate persons, too. The problems that arise are very complicated."
"Isn't it up to the society to solve its own problems?"
"It is, but we studied that society throughout time, and it doesn't solve the problem satisfactorily. Remember that its failure to do so affects not only itself, but all its descendant societies. In fact, there is no satisfactory solution to the mass duplicator problem. It's one of those things like atomic wars and dreamies that just can't be allowed. Developments are never satisfactory."
"What makes you so sure?"
"We have our computing machines, Noyes. Computerplex is far more accurate than any ever developed in any single reality. These compute the possible realities and grade the desirabilities of each over a summation of thousands and thousands of variables."
"Machines,"
she said it with scorn. Harlan frowned, then relented hastily.
"Now don't be like that.
Naturally, you resent learning that life is not as solid as you thought. You and the world you lived in might have been only a probability shadow a year ago, but what's the difference? You have all your memories, whether they're of probability shadows or not, haven't you? You remember your childhood and your parents, don't you?"
"Of course."
"Then it's just as if you lived it, isn't it? Isn't it? I mean, whether you did or not."
"I don't know. I'll have to think about it. What if tomorrow it's a dream world again, or a shadow, or whatever you call it?"
"Then there would be a new reality, and a new you with new memories. It would be just as though nothing had happened except that the sum of human happiness would have been increased again."
"I don't find that satisfying somehow."
"Besides," said Harlan hastily, "nothing will happen to you now. There will be a new reality, but you're in eternity. You won't be changed."
"But you say it makes no difference,"
said Noyes gloomily.
"Why go to all the trouble?"
With sudden ardor, Harlan said, "Because I want you as you are. Exactly as you are. I don't want you changed, not in any way." He came within a hair of blurting out the truth, that without the advantage of the superstition about Eternals and eternal life, she would never have inclined toward him. She said, looking about with a slight frown,
"Will I have to stay here forever then? It would be lonely."
"No, no, don't think of it," he said wildly, gripping her hand so tight that she winced. "I'll find out what you will be in the new reality of the 482nd, and you'll go back in disguise, so to speak. I'll take care of you. I'll apply for permission for formal liaison and see to it that you remain safely through future changes. I'm a technician and a good one, and I know about changes." He added grimly, "And I know a few other things as well," and stopped there. Noyes said,
"Is all this allowed? I mean, can you take people into eternity and keep them from changing? It doesn't sound right somehow from the things you've told me."
For a moment, Harlan felt shrunken and cold in the large emptiness of the thousands of centuries that surrounded him up when and down. For a moment, he felt cut off even from the eternity that was his only home and only faith, doubly cast out from time and eternity, and only the woman for whom he had forsaken it all left at his side. He said, and he meant it deeply, "No, it is a crime. It is a very great crime, and I am bitterly ashamed. But I would do it again if I had to, and any number of times if I had to. For me, Andrew, for me." He did not raise his eyes to hers. "No, Noyes, for myself. I could not bear to lose you." She said, "And if we are caught?" Harlan knew the answer to that. He knew the answer since that moment of insight in bed in the 482nd, with Noyes sleeping at his side. But even yet, he dared not think of the wild truth. He said, "I am not afraid of anyone. I have ways of protecting myself. They don't imagine how much I know."